bonds between mother and daughter and father and daughter are at the centre of Anne Enright's new novel, The Wren, The Wren. Carmel McDara is the linchpin of the story. She is mother to Nell, a young woman in her 20s navigating the tricky landscapes of modern work and love. Carmel is in turn daughter to Phil, a famed but now deceased Irish poet whose work is much loved but who abandoned his wife and daughters. The book grapples with the ties of family and the traumas that are passed down from one generation to the next. And the work shows that not only is Anne Enright an accomplished novelist, she's also a dab hand at poetry, it would seem. Mary McGill has been reading The Wren for us. She joins me now from our Galway studio. Mary, Anne Enright, it has to be said, when it comes to dissecting and looking and analysing the whole dynamic of Irish families, she has a particular skill in that area. And in this book, she's looking at that aspect of Irish society from three very different perspectives.
She sure is, Sean. I mean, she's probably one of the greatest chroniclers, if not the greatest chronicler that we have, of the unique situation that Irish families present, both in the present and, of course, in their very complicated past. And we get that in spades with The Wren, The Wren. We open the novel with Nell, who is 22 when it begins and kind of progresses through her 20s as the plot develops. But she's in that kind of strange liminal space between finishing up college in Trinity and then trying to embark on some sort of life, some sort of career for herself. She's making bad romantic decisions. We'll talk, I'm sure, a little bit more about those and how the past, the spectre of her creepy grandfather, Phil, as she thinks of him, is kind of informing her present choices in a sense. But she's also still trying to pull away from her mother, Carmel. And Carmel, they're both living in Dublin initially, and Carmel is still very involved in her daughter's life. You know, she tells Nell as she's growing up that she is her whole world, and Nell feels that deeply, and of course is trying to assert her own independence in the background sometimes, and sometimes looming very much into the foreground as well in terms of how Carmel and Nell live their lives, is this spectre of Phil McDara, this great man of Irish letters, who was not a great man when it came to fatherhood. So there's lots going on there in terms of familial dynamics for Ms. Enright to play around with.
And there certainly is. And I should clarify, actually, you're not in the studio at all. You're at home on your tie line. On your,
hi. Yes.
you're speaking to us.
Surprise.
From there. Yes. And
magic.
That's perfectly
yes.
acceptable too, Mary. Now, you've mentioned the... I will come back to the whole mother-daughter dynamic and that particular aspect of the story, but the great Irish poet is very important in the telling of this story. He looms, this character of Phil, he looms large over the entire novel and over both daughter, as in Carmel, and granddaughter, as in Nell, in over both their lives.
Absolutely. And I have to emphasise how well Enright does this. This is a masterclass, Sean, because it would have been a real temptation here to, I think, take his work. So Phil's poems are scattered throughout the text and make it bad. You know, make it kind of, you look back and go, well, how were those poems celebrated? Sure, they weren't even very good to begin with. These are very good poems.
Let's clarify. You're saying Phil's poems, but it's Anne Enright's poems.
It's Anne Enright's poems.
Writing
exactly,
Phil's poems
exactly
for him.
Exactly that. Exactly. I remember reading it. I was like, this could have been in my soundings poetry book for my Leaving Cert. This sounds like it's right out of the Irish canon. So we get a sense that, yes, Phil was this incredibly talented man. And one of the things he drew extreme inspiration from was his many relationships with women. And they read exquisitely, Sean. They're beautiful on the page, the imagery, the technicality of his writing. You know, he surely had a way with words, a true gift. We get why the man is so celebrated.
Yes, I would love to ask Anne Enright, you know, has she got some secret poems of her own? Because and they go across, I looked at several of them across the book itself. They will go across some, you know, wonderful wordplay. There's one about the rivers in Dublin, the puddle and the dargle, and she's playing around with, said the daughter to the tolka, will you come and dance the polka? But it's not, it, you know, it becomes serious further down in that poem. And there are several other poems which deal with things like the migration of birds, with family dynamics. These are, you know, they're poems that stand on their own rights apart from anything else.
Absolutely. And they're critical as well to the narrative itself and how... how in our rush to glorify people, we actually remove their humanity in a way that's actually diminishes our capacity to understand the richness of their work. So, for example, The Wren is the title of a beautiful poem that Phil writes about Carmel, his daughter, who's growing up. And the poem is a sense that Carmel is this beautiful, delicate thing that ultimately is going to leave him. Now, if you knew nothing other than that poem, you would think, oh, well, beautiful. That's a man who clearly... Beautiful, yeah. But we don't. And I think this is where this text works so brilliantly, this contrast between the work, the artist, but also the man, and the fallout from this beautiful work, but the reality of what that means for the family that he abandoned effectively.
Yeah, because
and I think, you know...
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, Enright doesn't, you know, tie in any bows around this. She just sets out these dynamics and how they bounce off one another. And I found it, you know, so often we have these conversations nowadays about what it means to kind of look at art when we know, you know, about the bad stuff that the artist did. And I think Enright is really tapping into this here. She's not telling us what to think, but in placing these various elements together, there's something about it adds something to your appreciation of the poetry.
Absolutely.
It does something.
I thought when you said she's not telling us, she's showing us, in fact, is what she's doing.
Yes,
by it's the classic form of storytelling. She's showing rather than telling, and doing that brilliantly by having the poems interspersed throughout the book, as you say, and so important to the narrative itself. However, part of the dynamic here is, if we turn our attention to Nell for just a minute, part of the dynamic is that she herself is a budding writer and has to, you know, come out from the shadow of this grandfather, just putting her mother to the one side for the moment. But that in itself is a task for Nell to navigate through, and her own love life is kind of affected by that, I think you could argue.
You could absolutely could, Sean. I mean, when we meet her, she's not making great decisions when it comes to men. I mean, if you want to be Freudian about it, you talk about how we recreate, you know, situations from our past, and of course our parents' past, and all this stuff gets you know, carried through the generations. And here we meet Nell, and she's become fixated on this fella, I'm trying to be diplomatic to him, called Phelim, and Phelim leaves a lot to be desired, you know. And I think Nell's a really interesting character as well, because she's a Gen Z, she's a young woman who's grown up in a very different Ireland, an Ireland where we've had and are having lots of different types of reckonings, lots of conversations around consent and positive sexual relationships and so on. And yet, the guy that she becomes hooked on is emotionally unavailable, abusive, you know, very coercively controlling, like all of these things that we now have words for. So Nell knows. And yet there is something within her that is drawn to the kind of absence that Phelim presents. Mm. And she accepts his cruelty. She nearly pursues him more because of it. And as the novel goes on, we learn more about Phil and indeed Carmel as well, right? Because Carmel has been impacted. She's this fierce independence that has made it very difficult for her to form, you know, a lasting romantic relationship. She actively chose to become a single mother, and I think part of that is because, you know, she saw her own parent, the way her own mother was abandoned literally when she was dying. So, you know, that's got to do something to you in terms of how you regard long-term relationships and so on.
Yeah, because she has brought Nell up as a lone parent. That's how she's done that particular aspect. So there's the absence of the father figure for Nell, which possibly is why the grandfather has such a Freudian, to use your term, has such a Freudian hold over her, perhaps.
Absolutely. And she's, you know, but also there's just the case that it's the family business in a sense. So like Nell is drawn to writing, and she, you know, she's actually writing poems, and she says it feels more authentic to write them on scraps of paper, bits of things, rather than in an actual notebook. She's writing awful content for websites and influencers, you know, travelogues about places that she's never been to. But you get a sense that this is in her. She is heading this direction. She can't help it. But she's also in a situation where this is not the easiest territory for Carmel, who she is so close to, who is her only parent. So there's a real tension there.
Yeah, and it's what I kind of enjoyed about that aspect of the book is it's not a classic, you know, problematic mother-daughter relationship. There are lots of very positive sides to it and lots of very negative sides to it, which is a rounded relationship.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think Enright does a really good job of drawing that out. You know, you've got this. I was rereading recently Virginia Woolf's essays on what it is to be a woman writer, you know, a room of one's own. And in that she goes, you know, can we even talk of woman writers? Like, what would that look like? And of course she was writing in the 20s, so we don't have, you know, or we didn't, there wasn't then the examples that we have now. But I think in this, and with the characters of Nell and Carmel, and again to go back to the way those poems are juxtaposed. In the poems, the women are flat and they're voiceless and they're exquisitely rendered, but it's through the prism of Phil, it's through the prism of man's gaze and a man's language. But Enright writes these women into life. Like, they are built around these poems, and yet they are so much more alive and so much more complicated and so much more real than anything in these poems can hope to say about what it is to be human or what it is to be female. And I think that for me, you know, when I was thinking of what it means to write like a woman, I think, I don't know if Enright was doing this intentionally as she was writing the book, but to me, reading it, I was like, look at how alive and rich and complicated these female characters are
What about
against
Auntie?
these, admittedly,
What
sorry, go on.
About Auntie Imelda, the older sister of Carmel?
Well, Carmel is in a sense, you know, the keeper of her father's fame. She looks after his legacy. Somebody has to do
Imelda
that
does
job.
that,
And of
isn't
course,
it? It's Imelda, the older sister, who does that, isn't it?
Imelda does, yes, sorry, Imelda does that, you know. And I suppose somebody has to perform that role. And Imelda's the older sister, kind of, I suppose, has that more sense of responsibility. And of course, it's very interesting between Imelda and Carmel as well. And again, this is Enright really tapping into familial dynamics. They remember things differently. You know, same house, same activities, same experiences, but differently remembered, different personalities. And so I hope I'm getting across, Sean, that this is a really engaging, really,
No,
really rich
I think
novel.
your positivity is quite audible. I think it's fairly
Good.
clear. Might I ask, and of course I would ask this, wouldn't I, is probably what you would say to me. Phelim, the boyfriend, Phil, the granddad, the absence of father, not because Nell's father was in any way cruel. It's just Carmel decided she wanted a child, and she went about doing that in a way that meant that she didn't have to have ties to any particular man. Is there any redemption for the male of the species in the midst of this novel?
Yes, I think there is. And I also think that Enright is also saying something as well, I think in the case of Carmel, that, you know, at one stage she meets a perfectly nice man. But it's not that there's anything wrong with him, but it's also her capacity to trust and love and make room for a relationship in her life. So it's not the case that all the men are ogres or anything like that. And
But
you
he's a
know,
bit
there's
boring and mild-mannered, the man she meets, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. You know, he's not setting her on fire. But then I wonder, for Carmel, would anyone? You know, and that's, people are complicated. It's not like, you know, as I said, it's not like all the men are ogres or anything like that. But we are the result of the experiences that we've had. And for Carmel, those experiences might make it difficult for her to click with someone, quite understandably, in a romantic context. Nell is growing up and she's learning. And awful and all as that experience with Phelim is, it begins to lead her to more positive places. And I think,
Yes.
you know, in the sense of growing up and the sense of hopefulness, this is a really hopeful novel. I think Enright absolutely brings that through. We're not worried for Nell by the end of the novel. I'll say that much.
And yes, I agree with you on that, and we don't need to say why or how. However, there was one thing I meant to mention when we were talking about the poems scattered throughout the book. It's the acknowledgements at the back of the novel from Anne Enright. My heartfelt thanks to poets Jessica Traynor and Jane Clark, whose light, deft interventions made Phil's fictitious lines look more like real poems. And then, I love this bit too, apologies and thanks to Paul Muldoon, whom I waylaid in Dublin Airport with Phil's version of the Yellow Bittern. And she puts in brackets afterwards, I can't believe I did that. So she obviously kind of doorstepped Paul and said, have a read of this, what do you think? But obviously it paid off. The poems read really well.
They read, read, but you know, and they do, Sean, but they also read. There's something deeply Irish and the deeply Irish canon about them. Like I said, they could have been in my soundings poetry book.
Yeah, but
before
did
I'm
she
leaving.
Avoids pastiche even in the
She
midst of that
does.
as well?
And like I said, she could have had a cheap shot. She could have made these weak poems, or she could have played with cliches endlessly, and that would have been a joke and it would have been fine. I actually think it's far more effective to do what she has done, which is create exquisite poems that you go, okay, fair enough. This guy was a serious talent. and yet, and yet.
Yeah, you've had a great read. Have you any caveats in the midst of all of what you're saying, Mary?
No, I found it. Look, this is one of the best novelists of her generation. I mean, the only reason you wouldn't read this is if you don't want to be moved, if you don't want to be entertained, if you don't want to think about, you know, bigger questions about what it means to grow up, you know, in a chaotic environment, what it means to have a daughter who's going out into the world. All these rich questions that Enright looks at. I have no hesitations whatsoever in recommending this, Sean.
I like that. If you don't want to be moved, don't buy this book.
Yes.
So if you do want to be moved, etc., etc., do buy this book. Mary, thanks very much for your thoughts on that. That's Mary McGill speaking to us about Anne Enright's latest novel, The Wren, The Wren, which is published by Jonathan Cape. You're Needy sounds frustrating is a new show from Taste in Your Mouth Theatre Company. It's about to open for the Dublin Fringe Festival. It's a 30-minute piece involving one actor, Leisha Murray, and one audience member at a time. Carrie, played by Leisha, is living in the bathroom of her parents' house. She's hardly eating or sleeping, but she's taking a lot of baths, doing a lot of yoga in a quest for purification. Your role as the single audience member is to listen and to answer a few questions that will be put to you in the midst of the 30-minute show, which is clearly taking aim at the wellness industry. Delighted to have director Grace Morgan and actor and co-creator Leisha Murray with me in studio now. Leisha, you know, there's great fun in all of this, in that it is dealing with the wellness industry and it is having a poking a bit of fun at that. Was that your starting point, or what was your starting point?
Well, we began sort of, it was in 2020 that we first started thinking about this piece. So we were in the middle of lockdown, and we were thinking a lot about how much time we were spending doing our yoga, doing our skincare when there was nothing else to do, and how much messaging we were getting on social media about, you know, what are you doing to improve yourself? What are you doing with this time? So we began to sort of investigate our own relationships with wellness and whether or not our relationships were healthy or not. So yeah, it was kind of a mix of those two things were the starting point.
The script, Grace, I'm guessing that your relationships with wellness were perhaps a little bit not well.
Yeah, well, I think we were all quite aware of our relationships to the industry, so I think we're kind of exploring the darker side, and I think we do have, you know, we would have healthy enough relationships with it, but we were definitely aware of how dark it can go. And I think it's a conversation that doesn't always come up with this industry because it looks so pretty and shiny until you look a bit closer.
Yeah, because that was one of the things that really struck me in the reading of it. Because, you know, initially I'm kind of laughing and saying, they're going to poke fun at the wellness industry here. But very quickly, there's a line, I think I jotted it down here, about blood from the nose is inner crying. I mean, that kind of stopped me in my tracks quite suddenly, because you think, well, number one, why is this person, which is your character here, Leisha, why is this person, why is her nose bleeding? And she's referring to this as some sort of cry from inside. It kind of immediately tells us there's a serious, very serious theme at play here too.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think because when we were first talking about it, like what makes the wellness industry potentially a bit insidious is that it connects a lot of other areas of life. So most people have some sort of relationship with the wellness industry, whether it's through something normal like the gym, dieting, or through something maybe a little bit darker. And because we all have access to the wellness industry, we also have access to the pipeline that can lead to something a little bit more serious. I mean, I think something we're really interested in is showing this kind of shiny view of what the wellness industry could be. But then when you look a bit closer, it could be something different.
Because the character keeps talking about this whole idea of whether or not she's going to become pure. She's on a path to purification. Which even the sound of that is slightly disturbing, Grace.
Yeah, totally. And I think kind of what you were saying, like from the start, you know, we want to kind of let the audience member know that everything is not what it seems. This is not the wellness trip that you might think you're taking part in, you know? And so I think that's quite important to us. And when we were making the piece, to do that from the start and be like, you know, the moment you walk into that space, something is a little off. The kind of tension of her trying and trying and trying and to get there. And I'm not going to, you know, say whether she does or she doesn't. Yeah. But, you know, I think what we do see is a woman who is going through various different states of this journey and the effects that they might have on her, whether good or bad.
Yeah. And sometimes it's a voiceover that's speaking kind of to telling us, like, yes, a shiny voiceover telling yeah. us yeah. the great things that you can get, you know, positive affirmations, all of this kind of thing that that you would get from various self-help books, mm-hmm. not just the wellness industry. Let's face it, there's a whole yeah. there's a whole raft of places that you can get this type of information. Mm. However, it's all taking place in a bathroom.
Exactly.
What is the, I suppose, what dynamic does that bring to the piece for you, Leisha?
Yeah, the intimacy is very unique.
It's you as
it's just
character
us two
and one person, one yeah, audience member.
And that level of proximity, you know, there's really very little space between me and the audience member, and that creates something entirely new. It means that I can talk and write down in a whisper and they can hear absolutely everything I'm saying. And that also sort of bends time. I mean, theatre can do that anyway, but, you know, 1 minute can feel very, very different depending on what's happening in the scene. And I think 30 minutes, it can feel like a very long time or a very short time, but it is a very unique time to spend just with one person one-on-one like that in such a kind of focused environment. Mm-hmm. So it's very exciting as a performer, yeah. hopefully as an audience member.
Yeah.
And I presume, Grace, were there specific styles or specific companies, I'm thinking of Anna Productions in particular, where you often have that, maybe not just one-on-one, but, you know, certainly very small groups of people in the audience. And this has been there before. I'm thinking of Mark O'Halloran's play. It was Rent was set in the bedroom.
Yes, yeah.
But it was more than one person in the bedroom. But nevertheless, were there specific companies and pieces like that influenced you in the choice for this piece?
Yeah, well, I think we've kind of, you know, we're huge admirers of Anu's work, definitely. And I think when we were in college, they would have been, you know, we would have seen like all of their shows and that they were doing. And so they were definitely a big influence as well. It's funny, we actually started the piece when we started in 2020, we were doing it for a Kirka Durka program called Show. And you know, obviously, you know, kind of pioneers as well of offsite work. So yeah. I think that was definitely an influence as well. And that's kind of how we came to the bathroom. We've always kind of had, we've been interested in doing work that's not necessarily in theatre spaces. And we've done it, you know, before a couple of times. So I suppose our natural instinct with this was just, we all saw it in a bathroom. So we're like, well, we're not going to build one in a theatre. We're just going to do it in a bathroom.
So explain, where did you... Have you been auditioning bathrooms? Have you been sampling bathrooms?
I mean, yeah, it's hard to find a good bathroom with a bath in Dublin.
Yeah.
But we have found one, so we're very lucky. But the rehearsal process has been quite funny because we have just been going around to people's bathrooms with baths and using their houses.
So it has to have a bath. That's a very important
aspect. It has to have a bath.
Aspect.
That's a really important aspect, yeah. So we've been going around to friends and family being like, do you have a bath? And can we rehearse there for a couple of hours? And so, yeah, so all of us just kind of like, yeah, it, like... completely invade their house and just hide in the bathroom, and then they all have heard, like my family have heard the show this time a million times at this point because we've been rehearsing there. And so yes, we have a good idea of, we know exactly what we want in a bathroom now, exactly what we want.
Yeah, and that's also the idea as well, that it's fairly adaptable, that we want to be able to make small adjustments that it can go to a lot of different bathrooms. It doesn't have to be a very specific template. As long as there's a bath and a few other things, then we can probably do it.
But I'm guessing for you as a performer, Leisha, that, you know, the various different bathrooms even that you've been rehearsing in must bring a very different feeling to how the character behaves. And of course, because it's a one-on-one with just one audience member,
absolutely,
it'll be very, very different show from performance to performance.
Yeah, I'd say the biggest influence is the audience member. Absolutely. Everyone brings a really different energy, how much they want to be involved.
Because you ask the audience member, will be asked
a lot
questions.
Of things, yeah. And they're always free to say no as well as yes.
Yeah.
And I have to be prepared for that. But even just the amount of eye contact someone wants. Sometimes we've kind of, when we've done rehearsals with people, there are some people that really don't want that. And I have a responsibility to sort of respect that as well. So the amount that an audience member is up for it also depends on how intense my performance will be or how the performance will go. So yeah, that, and then even just little silly things like how deep the bath is and whether it's kind of rounded or square and all these things, how I float, you know, there's various factors that are more scientific.
How much did the script change? I'm just even wondering, you know, when you're writing something, were you already thinking of the bathroom setting at that point in time? And even when you got into various bathrooms to rehearse, how much did things change in that situation, Grace?
I think, yeah, things changed a good bit. Like, I think a lot of what changed was the audience interaction and really minor things to where we put things in the room and how easy things are to get. And I think when we thought about the piece, I think the bathroom kind of came before the content, and a lot of the time that is how we work. Sometimes we just kind of see where it is first, and then we figure out what happens. But yeah, it has changed. It has changed depending on bathrooms we've been in. We've had to change a lot of the language or actions that Leisha does, a lot of things she does in the bath, and you know, you can't do in certain shapes of baths. So there is kind of always a bit of adapting depending on the space that we're in. But it's good practice for the real thing when we get into the real bathroom.
And you have chosen your specific bathroom. Where would that be?
It'll be not too far from here, actually. It's in Donnybrook.
In Pembroke Cottages.
Down in Pembroke Cottages, yeah. So we're there 3 times a day during the weekdays and 4 times a day at the weekend.
Yeah, so I suppose the specifics of the bathroom were one thing, but you also had to have a house where you could be in the bathroom 3 times a day.
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
For the period of the run itself. Mm-hmm. You were saying, actually, before we came to air, that you're now an expert on bathrooms, and that if the theatre goes awry on you, that's your next job.
That's what I'm going to do, yeah. Absolutely. Be a bathroom expert. Set up advisor. Yeah. That's my expert.
And you can also write books about what your bathroom says about you.
I
hear the podcast already.
I know, number one bestseller. Yeah.
In that respect too, Leisha, the whole idea of the company itself, Grace has spoken quite a bit about how you work together. It's yourself, Grace, and Wildon Levy, that are the major parts of the theatre company. How would you describe the philosophy of what you're doing, or what moves the shows forward?
Yeah, it's really, really collaborative. So the three of us sort of have a say in everything that ends up being in the piece. We usually start from anything from an image to an idea. Like for this, it might have been the bathroom and then an image that was associated with that. And then we move forward with that and we write collaboratively. We each have our own kind of disciplines that we mainly work in. So like mainly I'm the actor, Grace is mainly the director, and Will is usually the writer. But we also are sort of flexible in that. We're happy to move in and out of roles. So it's flexible, it's collaborative, and it's fairly experimental as well.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So, what are you hoping people will take away from this, Grace?
Well, I hope that when people leave, they'll think about their own relationship to the wellness industry, and also the messaging that they receive, particularly online, and to just kind of think twice about those things. I hope they'll be moved. I hope they get a little giggle out of it. I kind of hope that, when we make another show, they'll want to come and see that.
Yeah, you're not expecting them to be purified at the end of the
30
minutes.
You're not
expecting that.
No.
Listen, thanks to both of you for coming in and speaking to us about it this evening. That's the show, Grace Morgan and Leisha Murray, speaking to us about their show, which is called You're Needy, Sounds Frustrating. It runs at Pembroke Cottages in Donnybrook in Dublin 4, with a preview on the 14th, and then runs up until the 23rd of September as part of Dublin Fringe Festival, and you'll get full details on fringefest.com. All right, it's Sean Roxon Friday at the moment. Here we are in album reviews here on Arena. Time for that, my favourite part of the week, I must say. First up will be Slow Dive, formed in 1989. Darlings of the early 1990s British indie press. They enjoyed a short-lived career on the Hypercred Creation label before British fans and media dispensed with the shoegaze movement of which they were part. Then they reformed in 2014. They're back now with a new album called Everything Is Alive. Next up, Birdie, musical moniker of the highly prolific English singer and songwriter Jasmine van der Bogaard. She is 27 and releases her 5th album, believe it or not, today, with shades of 1980s luminaries like Walter of and Kate Bush. It's called Portraits, this new album. And finally then, from the other side of the Atlantic, the duo Danger Mouse and Gemini. Danger Mouse, one of the most acclaimed producers, I think it's safe to say, in hip-hop and modern soul, alongside Brooklyn MC Gemini. Born Again is the title of an album they recorded 2 decades ago, but it's just seeing the light of day now. I don't understand that part of the story, but I'm sure both John Maher and Kellyanne Byrne, who are with me in studio, will enlighten me as we go along. Let's start with the English band Slow Dive. Everything Is Alive is the title of their 4th album since their foundation in 1989. They're very fond of the hour long intro, so they are. So I'll talk a little bit before we get to hear the track Shanty, which has nothing got to do with the sea, as far as I can make out. And if you can work out what they're saying, then you might be able to tell me what these lyrics are all about as well. I'll be singing with you now in a couple of seconds' time. There you go there, a bit of Shanty from Slow Dive and their new album, Everything Is Alive. As I said, Kellyanne Byrne and John Marr are my reviewers on this Friday evening. I suppose, you see, I'm tempted to go two different routes on this and talk about the wonderful textures and the wonderful feel, the wonderful atmosphere that they create with that music. I'm tempted to go that route at one level, John. I'm also tempted to say there was a reason that, as I said in my introduction, British fans and media dispensed with the shoegaze movement, and mostly it had to do with that type of lyric and those textures.
Yeah, I think there's, I to a degree, it slipped out of fashion, and yet shoegaze continues to exert a force on me and many other people of my vintage, I have to say.
And it would have been, you know, the early 90s was very
the
much
early 90s was very much that idea. I probably was one of those people who fantasized about being in a shoegaze band staring at my shoes as well. And there's a lot to celebrate, I think, with Slow Dive. I loved their comeback album, their self-titled album in 2017. I thought there were some fantastic moments on it. I think this is a much more low-key album. Doesn't grab me in quite the same way that did. But yet, that word you mentioned, texture, it is all over this. And I think for people that love that form of music, there is a lot to enjoy here. For those that gave shoegaze a wide berth in the early 90s, there's very little here that they're going to go, do you know what, I need to rediscover this.
Yeah. However,
I disagree.
putting all my cynicism to one side, then there is, you know, some of the members of this band have known each other since they were 6 years old.
Yeah.
And they're still talking to each other and they're still making music together. And that in and of itself kind of makes me warm a little bit more to them, Kellyanne.
Yeah, well, Rachel Goswell and Neil Halstead have known each other since they were six. They've been in this band since they were teenagers. As John mentioned, when Pygmalion came out, they had three albums under their belt. Sadly, they were dropped by Creation. But I disagree. I prefer this album to Slow Dive.
I do.
Why? Because I just felt it was so cinematic. It captivated me from the start. I almost thought it was, there was something really otherworldly about it. I think the fact that the album was inspired by deaths in the family too. Two of the members lost parents. From the first track, Shanty, I paused and I listened to it right till the end.
Yeah, because there are certain songs where you get, I mean, even Prayer Remembered, which is the second track on the album, and A Life, which is the third track on the album. You get a sense that something is being remembered here, and it isn't being remembered by lyrics that are spelt out to us. It's being remembered by musical textures. Yeah. The third track of the album is called Andalusia Plays. And again, it's all about texture here, but this is even gentler than the opening few tracks on the album. The opening section there of Andalusia Plays from Slow Dive and their album Everything Is Alive. And John, this started out, I think it was going to be a solo project from Neil Halstead, in fact. And I think you get a sense of that in that song.
You do, and it's probably a little unrepresentative of the rest of the album. But
because it's more, that's the most like an ordinary song, conventional song.
Yeah. It actually reminds me a little bit of the Blue Nile.
Say what I just said, or I'll kill you.
You were going to say Yola Tango.
Yeah, well, I said it reminded me of Yola Tango. And he was like, you're so right. Like, if you say that, I'll kill you. No, but it reminded me of On Our Way to Fall in Love by Yola Tango. I thought this song was so unbelievably beautiful. It was really, it gave me goosebumps.
Yeah, I don't know if you're as convinced by it as Kellyanne is, John, because you're still, I think, referring back to some of the earlier stuff. But it manages to, this one of the shoegaze problems was, it was kind of so, it came across sometimes as very
introverted
and a little bit nihilistic. Yeah. There's optimism in here.
I think there is, and there's a warmth. I mean, that's a word that I keep, like a kind of a woozy kind of warmth. The sound is beautiful. I mean, don't get me wrong, I think this is a really good album. I suppose, loved the more obvious touch points of the comeback album from a few years ago. And this does feel like a band who've been around for well over 30 years, taking stock and going, okay, what are our strengths here? And can we do something a bit different? Yeah. And doing it very well. And I also think, you know, there's 8 tracks here. It's not an album that will outstay its welcome by any shape or form, but there's confidence in that. They know they've delivered something good. And I think that it's a kind of classic slow burn as well.
And also, it's not one for, you know, putting on when you want. It's a slow down album. It's late at night. It's probably headphones as well. Stars from you, John?
It's a very solid 4.
Solid 4. Kellyanne?
Solid 4 for me. I loved it, yeah.
And headphones and late at night? Is there any other time of day that you could do it?
Absolutely. After this show, Sean, I think it has to be.
Yeah, there's also John Creedon after this show, which I would be suggesting.
Of course, yes, indeed.
Then maybe later you can go to that. All right. Very solid. Double 4 there from Slow Dive and Everything Is Alive from both Kellyanne and John. Let's move on to album number 2, 2011, Birdie's debut single, Skinny Love, was a cover version of the Bon Iver track. Became one of the best-selling singles of that year. She was a teenager at that time. She's now 26. She's back with her 5th studio album. It's called A Portrait. So let's have a listen to the opening track. There's no shoegazing going on this track. That's Paradise Calling from Birdie and her album Portraits. Kellyanne, how much did... That's the opening track on the album,
yes,
isn't it?
Yeah.
How does that set the tone for what's to come further down the playlist?
Well, actually, no, I don't know, because it opens with a bang. For me, that was very OMG. I almost got an aha vibe off it. We just said that there. But no, I think this is kind of a big belter. And then after that, there's a track called Rain Catchers, and it goes very much into Kate Bush territory.
Yeah.
Then even more kind of, what would you say, subtle with Your Arms. And then at the end, it comes back up with the last track, which is very similar to the first.
So she brings us on, you're saying, a bit of an album journey then, does she?
Yeah,
to use that much hated word by many people. I don't mind it at all.
It ebbs and flows, though. I think she does. Yeah, I think she does. I just thought sometimes that the Kate Bush thing was so... It was too like Kate Bush for me.
Did it bother you?
Yeah.
John, did it bother you?
I love Kate Bush and I always like to be reminded of her, but it did feel as if she's kind of almost too much enthralled to Kate Bush. I mean, she does have a very good rendition of Running Up That Hill, just elsewhere.
Yeah.
And in the past, and she has spoken at length about her adoration for Kate Bush. But there are places where it feels like more than an homage, almost like she's kind of slipping out of who she is herself to do a kind of cover of Kate Bush here.
Yeah.
I think there are moments that are spellbinding. I love that song we just heard, that just those effervescent synths. Her voice is perfectly suited for that. For me, though, there were moments in this album where songs just didn't get out of first gear. I mean, it seemed a bit kind of elevatorish. And the skip button, nobody uses the skip button anymore, of course, but you know, I was swishing on my phone thinking, looking forward to this particular song finishing in something a bit better.
So
it felt a little uneven, I think.
All right. Well, that was how Paradise Calling the opener. I kind of liked Rain Catchers, which is a bit further down the playlist, but maybe it was the old classicist in me that liked the strings
at
the beginning.
Well, it's kind of busting.
Yeah, well, let's have a listen. Yeah, this is the one I'm thinking of. I hope it is. Strings at the start. Lots of people saying, oh, a new album from Kate Bush.
I know. I couldn't get past that.
Did you not like the strings? Are the strings very Kate Bush too? And I suppose Raincatcher is a bit of an homage. Is it an homage, a nod, or a steal?
I loved it. I didn't love it, sorry. I love her voice. I think she's got a great voice. But for me, when that came on, I just couldn't. The one after that sounded like Running Up That Hill.
Yeah.
It does. In places, it feels as though this is one of those albums about a specific artist. In that case, Kate Bush, where they've got loads of people involved to do their interpretations of Kate Bush. And, you know, wonderful as Kate is, sometimes I was thinking more of her than Birdie, listening to half of these songs.
That's what I thought.
Which is possibly a problem.
Yeah.
Possibly not for others, though, because the songs are good. A lot of the songs are very well constructed, beautifully produced.
Well, you see, is it an homage to Kate Bush, or is it, you know, just too much like, does it sound too much like Kate Bush is the question.
Yeah.
I go with the latter.
Yeah. You have the latter for you, Kellyanne. Yeah.
Well, everyone has their inspiration, but like for me, it was just, yeah. But I think, like I say, she's got a gorgeous voice. She's got a voice way older than her years. And parts of, I loved like Your Low. I loved the ones that didn't sound like Kate Bush.
I mean, so you, go ahead.
I mean, she is fascinating in that you mentioned at the start that she came to fame as a teenager.
Yep.
And she's very precocious. And, you know, a decade in, she, like, despite rather incredible talent, it hasn't happened to her in terms of widespread appeal. She's still something of a fringe player. And I do think there are aspects of this album that can really push her into a large audience. But I think it could have been stronger.
All right. So you want more of Birdie and less of other people, including Kate Bush. Stars from you on this one, John?
Three for me.
Three. What are you saying,
Three
Kellyanne?
For me.
Three? Oh, in total accord.
We didn't consult beforehand, I promise you.
I'll judge,
just great minds,
I'll judge that when we talk about Danger Mouse and Gemini Born Again. So here we are talking about their collaborative sophomore album, Born Again, which was recorded between 2003 and 2004. Why on earth are we waiting? Can either of you enlighten me as to why we've waited 20 years? Kellyanne is bursting to go, John.
Yeah, because I can't say my verdict yet. Because... So basically, Danger Mouse released an album called The Grey Album back in 2004. It was a mashup of Jay-Z's Black Album and the Beatles' White Album. And due to the success of that, this one got shelved. And I think personal reasons too. But they had got an album out before that called Ghetto Pop Life, which is unreal. I only got turned onto that album from reviewing this, and it is incredible.
Okay. I think you've half given your verdict by saying that. Let's listen to the title track then, Born Again. Yeah, you are hearing little dips and ducks in there in that section from Born Again from Danger Mouse, because John, as Kellyanne was saying, and we were, I think, all nodding in agreement, difficult to find an unexplicit moment on this album.
Yeah, I had my kids in the car on the way over and playing the album, and I was moving it.
Talking every 3 seconds.
Every 3 seconds. And yet, despite the explicit nature of it, it doesn't feel gratuitous, which is quite a trick. Mm, I really like Gemini. You know, to give him his full name, Gemini the Gifted One. Mm-hmm. Really talented MC.
Call himself that.
He does indeed.
Yeah,
he does indeed.
Go.
I think we should all nick that every now and again and just throw it out there.
Sean, but the Gifted One.
Indeed. Sean Roxon Sunday, the Gifted One.
Yeah, go on, keep going. Thank you.
But his delivery is, there's something really engaging about it. He's a very... It's very measured, it's assured, it's relaxed. He's got a lot to say. It's observational lyricism. And around all of that is the pristine, inventive, brilliant production from Brian Burton, a.k.a. Danger Mouse.
I know. He could produce anything, this
anything.
Fella, really.
And he has. He's been a busy man.
Yeah. I mean, he's worked with the Yeah Yeah Yeahs. He produced Demon Days by the Gorillaz.
Adele, U2.
Black Keys albums. But I'm with John on what he said about Gemini. I think he's got so much wisdom and perspective. And I'm assuming he was quite young when this record was made, because it's 20 years ago.
Yeah.
They were kids.
To be fair, I know there's a kind of a throwback in terms of that disco-y organ sound in the background. Yeah. But it could have been made yesterday, this album, as well.
Absolutely.
It's very fresh.
It's incredibly contemporary, because so much of today's music is looking back to soul and from the 70s, old school hip hop.
Yeah.
But the sound is so utterly pristine. I mean, Bono has spoken before about Danger Mouse as a producer. He worked on Songs of Innocence, and just how precise he is.
Well,
it's here.
You can hear it across the album for sure. But in terms of contemporaneity, if such a word exists,
it does now.
Dealing with contemporary themes. Let's rephrase it in that fashion. What is Gemini hip hopping about here? Because he's in a sense that's where the content is. What's he singing about?
There's
what's
so
he talking
much going
about
on the album? Like, he speaks about poverty, growing up in the hood, family dysfunction. There's all of that going on, and then trying to find a place in the industry and have a unique voice as a hip hop artist. Mm. So there's all of those themes which are quite raw and gritty, but I think the balance is it's the production from Danger Mouse with the soulful, slick production that ultimately gives it this inspiring, upbeat.
So the hip hop is Gemini, the soul is Danger Mouse. Is that essentially?
They're a perfect match.
Yeah. Let's have a listen to a bit of a track called Dear Papa. Again, a bit of a track called Dear Papa because you can't listen to all of it.
Now everybody always doing songs for the mamas and we love the mamas. But this song for the daddies and the baby daddies and the daddy daddies and the step daddies. I walk just like him, talk just like him. We wanted, they called him a thug. So I understand why he wasn't the type to give hugs to him.
You know, it's such a positive song that's Dear Papa from Danger Mouse and Gemini. And clearly Gemini wanted to pay homage to Daddy there for sure.
Yeah, I loved this. I thought it was probably the best song on the album. Mm. For me, it recalls Marvin Gaye, actually.
We were talking about Marvin Gaye. It was last night, because I'm only back. He was only back off holidays last night. Yeah, so last night we were talking about Marvin Gaye and Let's Get It On, being 50 years old, believe
exactly,
it or not.
Exactly, yeah. I thought that...
Although I don't think he'd be singing quite so nicely about his papa as Gemini was there. So
I don't think so.
No.
But the melody.
Yeah.
I think this song was really beautiful because it's him as an adult looking back. He didn't want to know his dad when he was younger because I think his dad wasn't around, but now he appreciates all the wonderful things about him.
I think
it's quite astonishing that this album has lain in the vaults for 20 years.
It is so good.
There were quite a few issues with the Grey album in terms of legal problems. I mean, even though the last remaining Beatles gave their blessing, the record company had a problem and it was held up at all. There was an element of Danger Mouse wanting to try something different. Gnarls Barkley happens and
Stars remember Gnarls Barkley? Yeah, they were
We can talk about this in 30 seconds time when we're finished. Stars from you, Kellyanne.
It's a big four from me. I loved it.
The big four.
Yeah.
I hate to say it, but it's four from me as well.
For heaven's sake.
I should have gone 4.5. I will go 4.5.
I've just proved that you have differing opinions.
Can I do 4.5 for slow?
No, you can't. Okay. All right. Very positive from both of you, clearly. Very close to the five for Born Again from Danger Mouse and Gemini. We also spoke about Portraits from Birdie and Everything Is Alive from Slow Dive. From The Gifted Two, I shall call them, John Maher and Kellyanne Byrne, our reviewers on this Friday evening. Yes, I will be with you on Sunday on RT Lyric FM, and I will be back with you here on Monday at 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1.